Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast. This episode, we have a real treat. We have Alan Mertens, designer of the 1992 Indy 500 winning Galmer chassis, the G92. Driven by Al Unser Jr. to the closest finish in Indy 500 history. This is also the car that Danny Sullivan used to win the Long Beach Grand Prix at the end of the season. Al Unser Jr. had finished third in the championship. Danny had finished seventh. And this one chassis, the Galmer G92, came and went in a single season, claimed the Indy 500. And that was it. Fascinating story behind all this shared by Mr. Mertens. This program came together in 1988 when he went to work for Rick Gallus, which then merged into the Gallus Craco Racing Team. It's their personal R&D program, based out of England at a time when a lot of IndyCar teams definitely did as much as they could on their own to advance the chassis that they'd purchased from March, from Lola. Penske had his own Penske Cars program where they built and did their own thing. Galmer was created in that same vein, but again, the first few years it was just truly to develop the cars that they were buying, make them a little bit better, try and find an edge. For 1992, they got the go-ahead from Rick Gallus and Maury Cranes to actually make their own, and what an impact they had. So what I love about this, we talk about a lot of fun things on the Marshall Pruitt Podcast. We do in-car audio, ambient audio, talk with the legends, the current stars of the sport. We don't get a chance to dive into the real engineering design side as much as I would like. That's completely my fault, and I can at least say that with this, thanks to Alan Mertens, we solved that problem quite a bit. Alan goes pretty deep about the car's great attributes, its failings, and if you love the technical side, this is just Alan being awesome, sharing a lot of really cool stuff. The one thing this car did at Indianapolis, and at every other track, mind you, but the one thing it did at Indy is it used one of, if not the earliest forms of a blown diffuser. Alan came up with really unique exhaust layout, which had not been done in IndyCar, really, and used this on the Galmer, brought it forward from something that he had seen a few years earlier, an idea that was had a few years earlier, used this to really advance the aerodynamics on the car. Also created a little bit of a problem, too, on throttle with the engine, the big Chevy wound up, turbo Chevy wound up, making a lot of power, flowing a lot of exhaust. This thing made plenty of downforce by helping to accelerate the air going beneath the car through the underwing diffuser, but off throttle, cut that downforce significantly. A lot like an on-off switch. So, big day at Indy in 1992, cold weather, Al's victory, a lot of crashes, Michael Andretti was running away and going to win the thing by a year, but pretty cool outcome for the smallest constructor, one-year rise. Huge accomplishment for them. And here we have the backstory and how the car came together. Everything it did right, everything it did wrong, all courtesy of Alan Mertens. Get every episode of the Marshall Pruitt Podcast on iTunes. Also, our Marshall Pruitt Podcast Facebook page is archived more than 150 episodes now as we are celebrating our one-year anniversary. With all that business done, off we go with Alan Mertens and the 1992 Galmer G92 Chevrolet.
So, Alan, you get to celebrate a pretty cool anniversary, 25 years since your Galmer chassis won the Indy 500 with Al Unser Jr. Before we get to the chassis itself, its design, the race, maybe start with where this concept came from. Because this is an era where almost everybody, maybe barring Roger Penske, were buying cars off the shelf, if you want to call it that, from a Lola or a March or otherwise. There weren't many real small boutique, low-volume chassis manufacturers in IndyCar, and then we hear you guys are doing something. So tell me about the formation of this and the decision to create the Galmer chassis.
Okay, well, with apologies, this goes back to the March days, and you may have seen or heard, or I may even related it to you personally, that instance where I was at March with Adrian Newey, and we both became disenchanted with March, and we tried to start up a breakaway company and go our own way. And we were negotiating with Maury Cranes and Pat Patrick as to be our first two customers, and we're intending to try and secure their custom along with their money to kickstart this new enterprise Adrian and I were trying to set up.
Yeah.
But then somehow or other, through Pat Patrick, Robin Hood got wind of it. And I think Robin Hood then, like, greased Pat Patrick's palm with silver by giving him Andy Brown's former 3000 car, reworked with the Buick engine, to give Pat Patrick the chance to start the Indy Lights program. And then what Adrian and I were trying to do all came out into the open, and obviously Robin took a huge exception to this. And this is when we make a joke about the fact that Adrian and I were called up to Robin's office, and we kind of, you know, we got our asses chewed big time.
Sure.
And I always made light of the fact that Robin then fired Adrian and kept me, which was a stupid decision, because obviously Adrian is exponentially more cleverer than I am. But I think in reality, the reason Robin did it that way is because he knew he'd never be able to keep hold of Adrian, because Adrian was too good. And he was always going to leave anyway. But he kept me there and chained me to the desk. And I carried on working on the 87 and the 88 car until the end of 87, when the 88 car was launched and finally left. Didn't know what to do with myself. Mm. And then I was approached by Ed Nathman on behalf of Gallus Racing, and asked if I would go and work for them. Because they had committed to buy the 88 car. And Ed's logic was, well, who better to actually run the car than the person who designed it? And so, of course, I jumped at the opportunity because I was effectively unemployed. And then that started the long relationship with Rick Gallus and Al Unser Jr. And unlike everybody else, for whatever reason, we were singularly successful with the 88 March, which in everybody else's eyes was deemed a failure.
Yeah.
But we managed to win four races and come second in the championship to Sullivan, who was racing with Penske. And then I think the bond that developed, particularly between me and Rick, and more so with Al Unser Jr., halfway through the year of 88, that's really what started Galmer. And of course, deep down inside, what I really wanted to do with Galmer, or with any entity for that matter, was to try and follow through on what Adrian Urien and I originally tried to do, was to try and create our own standalone IndyCar program and design and build our own cars. So when Galmer was created, actually during the course of the month of May, when I negotiated a deal with Rick Gallus, my intentions were always to be able to build and race our own chassis. But of course, Galmer in 88 really constituted as one person, which was just me. And then I had to slowly grow the company from there. We did that by not exclusively offering design and development work, as well as race engineering for Al Unser Jr. with Gallus. But I started to bring on more subcontract type projects from various Formula One teams, Benetton and Jordan at the time.
Sure.
And then we did some work for the Toyota, Le Mans cars and whatever. And then as the company grew and I got more engineers, we started to provide engineering support for other IndyCar teams as well. And then so on and so forth, to the point where obviously Rick went through hard times at the end of 89, which is in 90 when he first merged with Murray Cranes.
Yeah, yeah.
And became Gallus Craco. And then at the end of 90, Murray Cranes and Rick finally agreed to fund the Galmer car. And so through 91, we did the design and preparation to build the cars for 92. And so, very quickly, not that articulate, but as best as I'm able to describe it, that's how Galmer came about and the Galmer car. But it was something that I had an inkling to do essentially from the mid-80s onwards, but it didn't actually manifest itself until 92.
What were you looking at with the, say, the Lolas, Marches and Lolas of 90, 91, the 91 Penske and such, when you're getting ready to start putting pencil to paper, what are you looking at with the state of the art of the other Indy cars from that 90 to 91 era when you're starting to pen the Galmer G92 for the 92 season? Were there things where you said, I like some of these aspects? Were there areas where you said, why isn't anybody doing this? Just curious, you know, where your mindset was on this design process, because it's not as if you hadn't designed a lot of cars before, but this is something to me where you really decided to say, all right, I don't have to answer to a Robin Hurd or to whomever else. I'm being entrusted to put my best ideas, my best foot forward. Where do you start?
We were particularly successful with the 1990 Lola, because that was the year that we won the car championship with Junior. And when we bought the 1990 Lola, or Gallus Craco did, it came down to the Galmer shop before we shipped it off to America. And we did a lot of load deflection tests on it and so on and so forth. And we found a number of identifiable weaknesses in the car, which we actually modified and changed in the 90 Lola before we shipped it to America. And then I think it's true to say that we were the most successful 1990 Lola car out there, because we did actually win the championship. And that was a legacy, a lot of the changes that we identified and modified in Galmer before, like you said, we shipped the car out. So now that was a very successful car for us, and that undoubtedly influenced the baseline of what ultimately became the 92 Galmer. But then what we had to do is to try and come up with some sort of concept that gave us an advantage that nobody else had actually thought of and nobody else had tried before, because, you know, Rick Gallus and Maury Cranes always said, you know, what we want to do is to emulate that so-called Penske unfair advantage, which of course was never unfair, but all of the teams that were competing against Penske, who were overwhelmed by Penske, always regarded his wealth and his organizational powers and his ability to develop his product as being, in their eyes, an unfair advantage, because they didn't have the sort of attributes that he had. And so if we were going to, as a small company, if we were going to take on the likes of Penske, I felt that we had to do something radical to create our own unfair advantage, if you want to use that terminology, over and above anything that Penske could come up with. And the first concept was using Adrian Newey's philosophy, make the car as small as possible, reduce the base area of the car as much as possible to make it as aerodynamically efficient as possible, and then just try to fit everything inside it. And the car was very, very, very small. They've actually got a chassis still, just a chassis itself, not the rest of the car, in the Unser Museum here in Albuquerque. And I took my son and my daughter, who visited me last year, to go and see it. And even though Adrian Mertens was around at the time we did it, he was only like 7 or 8 years old. And he had no real concept of what was going on. And when he looked at the chassis compared to the current day chassis, he just was mind boggled. You know, how the heck did the drivers ever manage to get in that? And that philosophy was used throughout the car. It was very, very tightly packaged. But then that wasn't enough. There was that one extra thing that I wanted to do to try and make it competitive, or more competitive, was try to blow the tunnels. And the whole back end of the car was done on the principle of actually being able to energize the tunnels, much like the same way they did in Formula One decades later. By using the exhaust system, like for a blown tunnel.
Yeah, the blown diffuser.
And that's what drove the back end, that's what drove the gearbox, that's what drove the turbo installation, that's what drove all the underbody aerodynamics and everything, was particularly that concept. And it was that particular concept which ultimately turned out to be our Achilles heel, because we actually probably did it too soon. We were too early in doing that, and we didn't have the sort of degrees of control over it as what they ultimately had when they did it in Formula One, and where they were able to blow the tunnel off throttle as much as they could on throttle by burning raw fuel in the exhaust pipes to keep the velocity up. All that sort of stuff we didn't have, or didn't have the wit or wherewithal to figure out. And that kind of, the one thing that we won the Lewis Schwitter Award for was the one thing that actually let the car down. So
It was brilliant at the time, but I do remember reading about it in interviews, I believe in Race Car Engineering magazine, about Little Al saying that if he was on throttle, if we're maybe just looking at the Indy 500 or, you know, Indianapolis Motor Speedway, if he's on throttle, if we're talking qualifying or has some free road in front of him, being on throttle, keeping the turbo spooled up, the exhaust gases flowing, blowing the floor, we are, you know, making plenty of downforce from the underwing and everything is fantastic cornering wise. But if I'm having to lift on corner entry or mid corner or otherwise, the loss of that energy blowing the floor and creating that downforce was, you know, I don't want to say as like an on-off switch, but there was a definite noticeable change in grip and stability. So that certainly had its strengths, but also, you know, at that state and time, there was also some areas where, you know, you're trying to do something new that definitely showed that there was a little bit more development.
And we didn't, as much as I liked Mario Aurelian and Paul Morgan, they were aware of what we were trying to do, and they actually helped us develop the exhaust system on their dynos at Ilmore. When it came to the engine exhaust car interface, they didn't really help us anymore, because as far as they're concerned at the time, the line stopped somewhere between engine development and car and chassis development, and they weren't able to go beyond that, like, embedded thought process to follow it through to help with our problems. You know, as soon as it came to the end of the exhaust system, their responsibility was done. You know, as long as the exhaust flowed properly and it was efficient, beyond that, they weren't interested in what happened. And if there was an associated chassis problem with what we were doing, they probably never put any thought process into it to help us figure out what it was that we could do to actually make it better. And indeed, it took us a while to really catch on to what the problem was, because that on-off light switch type scenario you were talking about, it actually helped us on street courses. It was a huge gain on street courses, not so much so on road courses. Helped us very little, if anything, on mile ovals, and then just killed us at the super speedway.
And looking at the exhaust system itself, one of the things I've always wondered about is, you know, today with the current Indy cars, they're twin turbo V6s, obviously a dedicated turbocharger to each exhaust bank. You have individual exhaust outlets, obviously, because of the separate turbos. This is an era of single turbos, though, and it was fairly common, if not just the standard, for designers to use a single exhaust outlet because of the headers meeting up and working with the turbo and then routing the exhaust gases out. How did you come up with the idea, and how did you execute this to make sure that, you know, instead of just having one half of the tunnel blown,
Okay.
On one side.
There's another story behind this. So, well, first of all, I realized that if we were going to do it, we had to blow both tunnels. And then, and to do that, we had to turn the turbo through 90 degrees, which had never been done before. So we could split the exhaust down each side of the gearbox and have two wastegates, which also came down. So the wastegate exhaust came down either side of the gearbox as well. And this thought process first developed in March, when I used to be really good friends with a guy called Dave Williamson, who had this company called Parallel Motions. And he always used to do the exhaust for the March cars. And we were down the pub one lunchtime, and we were talking about, you know, I was a frustrated businessman, he wanted to make money, and so on and so forth. And we were talking about wastegates for some reason or other, and we started to talk about how inelegant the wastegates were that Phil Casey was selling, because they're big old cast iron things, they're extremely heavy, but they were efficient. And Dave said to me, well, I've found somewhere where I can get billets of titanium, actually very cost effectively. What if we did our own wastegate? If you designed it and I made it, what if we made our wastegates out of titanium so they're lighter? And I said, okay, well, we can do that. And he said, but the only way that would be cost effective is if we had two wastegates on each car. And I said to Dave, all right, well, if I design the March so it has two wastegates to make it commercially viable, why don't we go ahead and do the titanium wastegate, and then we'll split the profits between us? And he said, okay, that's good. He said, we'll do that. So we went ahead and did it. And then when we were looking at it, and we could see the twin wastegates and both the wastegate exhaust coming down either side of the tunnel, and I thought to myself, well, that'd be a good idea. One day, maybe we should actually think about blowing the whole tunnel with the whole exhaust system plus two wastegates. And I think that seed was sown, I think it was in 85 we did that, maybe 86, but that actually stayed in the back of my mind all the way up to the time when we started the Galma.
Wow. So you have this really unique exhaust installation. You've designed the car to use the underwing in a way that no one else is. You look at the front of the car, and it still looks like it could stab somebody. The nose is so tapered and so sharp. I mean, the car was so easy to pick out on track compared to all the other chassis. The roll hoop itself was very distinct, with that kind of forward the forward cantilevered aspect to that as well.
Yeah, well, that was a styling exercise. The sharp nose didn't really give any advantage over the slightly more blunted nose, as you might call it. And the curvature forward on the rear roll hoop was done purely for aesthetic reasons. We made sure it didn't make any difference in the wind tunnel, but we wanted to do that to give the car more of an aggressive appearance. We wanted it to be like looking like it's leaning forward, trying to be aggressive, trying to go for a target, trying to be focused. Everything was as if it was trying to forwardly focus on a goal or a prey or something. We just wanted that sort of aesthetic appearance to it, which we thought made it look cooler, to be honest.
And another thing that I loved about the car, and this obviously isn't a speedway trim, but a road course trim, your front wing package, your road course, I guess particularly street course, your high downforce front wing package was, if you covered over the rest of the car and just looked at the front wings, very, very Formula One-esque. And again, I could be forgetting, but I don't recall many, if any, other Indy cars in that 91, 92 era that really followed some of the leading edge stuff that was happening in F1 with front wings and end plates and curvatures and whatnot. Was that you just, you know, trying to make sure that you were not copying the IndyCar standard and looking outside of North America for anything that could be of value to try?
Well, I'll be honest with you, and that's all I ever been, is I'm always honest, even honest to a fault. That had nothing to do with me. that was Andy Brown. And, you know, as I think I said in the article I sent you, our original aerodynamicist left just before the start of the season, and I was able to hire Andy Brown, who was a huge, huge benefit for us. The guy is super talented. And it was Andy Brown that identified that our relatively standard Indy-type style front wing wasn't actually working when we got the flaps up to the level where we thought we needed to get the front downforce we were looking for. The front wing actually stalled out. So he had to come up with a whole new package. And he had actually just come from Leighton House. And surprise, surprise, that front wing came from Adrian Newey to Andy Brown to Galma. And so, you know, that little clique of March people that we all grew up with, we all grew up with each other at March, they were never ever that far away. There was always some influence that we had on each other over the years during our careers in motor racing. Of course, least of all Adrian, of course. I mean, he was a, you know, he was a god in his own right. I'm sure there's nothing that Andy and I ever did to influence Adrian, but that for years we never really strayed that far away from each other.
If we look at the G92's creation coming to life, it's been manufactured. Tell me about the first either full-scale wind tunnel tests or the initial testing. What was it like not only bringing it to life, but also starting to quantify its capabilities and also learn about, you know, its either strengths or the areas that you wanted to rapidly improve before the season started?
Well, I think, to be honest, can I just backtrack a minute? We go back to winning Indy. That was a very bittersweet experience for me because we were all proud of what we'd done, but we had so many detractors. That car came under so much criticism all the time for people, for whatever reason, like to criticize the car. After a while, it automatically always put us on the defensive. If ever anybody talked to us about the car, we feel we had to defend it. And to a certain extent, that mindset still exists, and I should be grown up enough to be able to shrug it off. But, you know, people saying that we got lucky with the win. Well, for the most part, in all the years I've been associated with Indy racing, there's only, you can count on fingers of less than one hand where any driver who's dominated the race has gone on to win it. It's always been a lottery. There's always been an element of gift, element of luck, element of being in the right place at the right time. And for sure that happened to us, but I don't see why that should be of more detriment to us or the Galma car than anybody else. So that was always difficult. And, you know, you take these small marquees, there's Swift, Riley and Scott, the True Sports car, and the Eagle car. There were several other small concerns that produced cars that never even made the show. I mean, in 95, Penske didn't even make the show. So at the time, we were happy just to make the show and over the moon when we won it, whatever the circumstances were behind the win. But for some reason or other, we always seemed to be made ashamed of the fact rather than other people celebrated our victory. But then going back to your question, we actually didn't realize we were in trouble for quite some time. When we first tested, one of the jewels in our back pocket was always testing at Big Springs in Midland, Texas. And that's where we did our testing primarily for Long Beach, and the track was very, very abrasive. And I remember there was always this infighting between Michael and Al. Michael once convinced us to go down to Big Springs to test because we always did it in the winter. And so he wanted to try it as well. And he went down there and he found the track to be so abrasive it was a waste of time. And they packed up half a day and went home. And we just stood at each other, laughing at each, with each other, saying, well, that's the whole point of being here. The track is so abrasive, it teaches you to put a setup on the car where you can save the tires, when you can get long life out of the tires. And then because that was where we went every year before Long Beach, that's why Junior was so good at Long Beach. It was all because of learning how to control tire degradation at big springs, and Michael completely missed the whole point. And to this day, I don't know whether he even realizes it.
But
also, fortuitously, the first race of the year was Australia, which is another street course. And Junior got his first ever pole position in the Galmer in Australia. He'd never had pole before, because pole never meant that much to him, because he said he could always win from the top five in that particular era of racing.
Yeah.
So the car went well in Australia. We ended up in first and second in Australia until the monsoon hit, and I think we ended up fourth and fifth. We would have been first and second at Long Beach if Danny hadn't taken out Junior, and we ended up being first and fifth or something, first going to Danny. So we were okay. We didn't realize we had a problem. And we didn't realize we had a problem until we got to Phoenix. And that's when we started to identify a problem. Of course, we still didn't know what it was. And then I think I mentioned to you in my article, there were two problems effectively. One was the blown diffuser, the blown underwing.
Yeah.
And the other one was that although the downforce levels and the balance didn't change much, for whatever reason, the drag changed when, first of all, we were testing at Portland, and I think I mentioned this before, we were running in the rain, and I was standing in the pitch watching him go by, kind of somewhat daydreaming, because I knew we weren't really going to achieve much testing in the wet. But I noticed the rooster tail was going above the pedestrian bridge that went across the track. and I mentioned this to Andy, and Andy said, well, let's go and measure it then. So we went over there and we measured the height of the pedestrian bridge, and then estimated how much further the rooster tail was going up above the bridge. And then when we got back, Andy measured the working section of the wind tunnel and found out the height of the wind tunnel was only about two-thirds of what it should be if there was an imaginary rooster tail in the wind tunnel, which of course there was, but it wasn't defined by spray. You couldn't actually see it.
Yeah.
And so basically the virtual rooster tail in the wind tunnel model was hitting the roof of the working section and blocking the efflux or the exhaust out of the working section and change the perceived aero data completely.
Wow.
So then we went from a quarter scale wind tunnel model to a third scale wind tunnel model and run it at Brackley. And the level of downforce didn't change too much, and the central pressure changed a little bit. But then for some reason or other, the drag changed completely. I'm not an aerodynamicist, and I don't really understand it. And I don't understand. I think if you try to think about it from layman's terms, you could almost kind of wrap your head around it. Why are effectively a blocked, a choked working section in a wind tunnel where there's not free stream down it, somehow or other ends up being perceived less drag than if you've got a working section where there's no obstruction and there's free stream all the way down it, and there's no upstream effect on the car because the air coming down the working section is not getting bottled up. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And then we realised that we had more drag than we thought we had. But then it was just trial and error and experience and experimentation, which ultimately led us to realize that we had a problem with the exhaust system.
So where do you go with this knowledge and information heading into the month of May? And I'll couch that with compared to today's month of May, which is a much shorter affair. Back then you had a lot of time, a lot more time to test, to run. I don't know how busy things were, you know, in the carbon shop or the machine shop at Galmer, trying to make, you know, various components for you to try at IMS. But what was it like coming into the month of May with the chassis, knowing that you definitely wanted to get rid of as much of the excess drag that you discovered as possible? Because around there, that, you know, that really can be the difference between winning and losing.
Well, for sure. There was not really that much we could do. It was pretty much hogtied with what we had. I mean, we did small things like modify the inlet and outlet of the radiator ducts, knowing that there's like higher sustained terminal velocity and the cooling efficiency would be better. And so, you know, we made the inlet and outlet ducts more aerodynamically efficient. But in all honesty, as the month went on, we kind of realized that we had problems. And it was a month where, I guess you could say, again, if I was being honest, and I never end up getting portrayed in a good light because I'm so negative about a lot of the things we did. But I'm just being realistic, to be honest. You know, the month of May basically became a series of ever progressive depressions as we realized that we were in more and more trouble. And this ended up with, on carburation day, and Junior said that you'd spoken to him, but he didn't say what the nature of the conversation was. But like after carburation day on Thursday, Junior was like totally bummed out, and even to the point where he had tickets to go and see Genesis with backstage passes, which he just gave to me because he didn't want to go. He just wanted to hide in his motorhome all night. But unbeknownst to us, of course, we had no idea that there was going to be such a huge climatic change come race day, where that climate change swung everything massively in our favor. Not to the point we could have beaten Michael, I admit that, but to the point where, you know, downforce was at a premium. You know, people having trouble getting heat in their tires, where we didn't so much have that same problem because of the level of downforce we had, because people weren't able to run flat all the time and everything. The drag, the perceived drag, well, not perceived, the literal drag on the car didn't seem to be much of a problem because, like, mechanical grip started to become more and more of a premium because of the weather conditions. And we had no idea that after Thursday, things would not turn around our way to the extent that, you know, we could dominate procedures. But the Junior, he never ever did try to dominate at Indy, maybe apart from the year of the beast. But even then, I think he was a long way behind Fittipaldi when Fittipaldi crashed. And, you know, what goes around comes around. Fittipaldi finally handed Junior a race win, as opposed to 89. But, you know, Junior's philosophy was that, and I think that's more commonplace this day and age, and that a lot of the drivers do it now, is that all you need to do is to stay on the lead lap until the last 25 laps. He did that in 89, and would have, should have, could have won it. And he always used that same philosophy. He did it in 92 as well. He made sure he was in the right place at the right time. And we were able to capitalize on Michael's misfortune.
So looking at race day and this, the supreme cold, the supreme cool that overtook the Speedway, I know you've already gone into this somewhat, but for those who either weren't there or haven't seen it, or, you know, learning about the unique aspect of race day in 92, what was it about the cold temperature, the thick air, etc., that definitely tilted things in your favor? Again, as you pointed, not to the level of displacing Michael, who was just on his own planet that day, but what was it about the ambient temperatures that, in conditions that really spoke to the Galmer G92 and allowed it to be, go from, you know, little Al being depressed on carb day to, aha, well, hey, we can probably have a pretty good day here.
Well, to be honest, for the first hour or so, we didn't realize it was a pretty good day. You know, we were just going through the motions of dealing with the race the best we could. And certainly the cold conditions, like I said, you know, people having trouble keeping heat in their tires, that wasn't so much of a problem for us. You know, because aero is V-squared, probably the delta difference in the denser air between our draggy car and other lesser draggy cars was less than what it would be with hot, thin air. But then one of the outstanding features of that day, of course, is Al's tenacity and common sense and his ability to think through things. He just wasn't like a bull in a china shop. He never has been. And, you know, he just used his wisdom and his talent, reading the situation, knowing what he could get away with, what he couldn't get away with, working his tools, getting the best out of the car, and being in the right place at the right time. You've got to remember, we spent all our time talking about the car, but, you know, the driver, Al himself, is a huge, significant factor in this whole process. Anything that I've ever achieved is largely due to Al, or our relationship with each other. It basically, you know, people loved Michael swashbuckling, bouncing off the walls, driving the car into the ground type trade switch. On the surface of it looked highly entertaining, but they always underestimated the sheer skill and tenacity of Alonso Jr. And as was documented time and time again, in much to the fury of Michael when he thought he had things covered, and in all types of races, for the most part, all of a sudden, there from nowhere would seem to come out. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, that's all him. And, you know, we were laughing about it the other day at lunch. But I worked with him for years and years and years, and he only ever made one mistake. He only crashed once where he made a mistake himself. And over an eight-year period, you know, six in kart and two in IRL, that's an amazing record. Any other wrecks he got in has been because of car failures or getting involved in other people's accidents.
So 25 years, Alan, that's a pretty cool number. Thoughts on the number itself, the fact that it's been a quarter century since this win, the validation, you know, for a chassis that had some folks who were fairly mouthy about its whatever deficiencies it may have been, but you know, the reality is, and as you mentioned, the fastest driver, most dominant driver, is rarely the one who was drinking milk at the end of 500 miles at Indianapolis. What are your thoughts about this 25-year anniversary, knowing that you guys continue to own the closest victory in Indianapolis 500 history, and also still a very popular one as well for Little Al?
Well, you know, the fact that it's been 25 years is kind of scary for me, insofar as that I'm only getting older and not getting any younger. And, you know, sometimes when I reflect on 25 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, it just, in a perverse sort of way, it kind of makes me sad because I'm still not living those glory days and how much I enjoyed it, but then also how much I took it for granted. And like we were talking about the other day, I've got no pictures of what we did. I didn't even record our history as such in terms of having memorabilia. So in some ways, I like to look back at it. It gives me a warm, fuzzy glow, but in some ways, I don't like to look back at it because it reminds me what I'm missing. You know, even now, I'd still love to be involved in motor racing, but I guess it's a young man's sport, and I've ended up spending the last 13 years in the commercial nuclear industry, which it pays the bills, but I don't enjoy it. And all it does is just reinforce how much fun I had back in the day when I was in motor racing. But in terms of specifically the 25 years since the win. I think if it hadn't been for you, Marshall, it probably wouldn't have even registered, because you're the only one that seems to have acknowledged that it's been 25 years, and indeed it does represent an anniversary. If you hadn't contacted me and we hadn't written to each other and we weren't having this conversation now, it would have probably passed by unnoticed, to be honest, which again in itself is quite sad.
Well, it's an important achievement, and you mentioned some of the other smaller marks that manufactured cars, and you know, there are those who throughout the history of Indianapolis that have had success, but this is you know, for what you guys achieved, a small concern coming together, highly ambitious, phenomenal talent, didn't have the most money, but certainly were willing and ready to take on the challenge of beating a Penske and Penske Cars and all, you know, these other large-scale manufacturers. This, to me, looking at where IndyCar racing is today with a single-spec chassis and so many things where innovation, evolution, and many other things are truly written out of the rule books to make them impossible, it is important to look back and say, hey, don't forget. Granted, it's 25 years ago, which is, you know, a lot of years, but don't forget that there was a wonderful time at Indianapolis when the Alan Mertens and Andy Browns and Alan Juniors and Rick Gallises and Danny Sullivans and you name it had ideas and put their ideas up against other people's ideas. And at the world's biggest race, those ideas won. So celebrate that, and maybe it'll help remind folks that going back to those days in some way, shape, or form where one person's ideas are allowed to compete against the other person's ideas, maybe that's not a bad thing to embrace again.
Yeah, you're right. In that respect, it's true. And, you know, you know that we put a proposal to the Iconic Board to actually build cars, the current generation of cars. And that might have been fun if we'd had it. Do you remember the BAR thing?
Yep.
Oh, sorry, the bat thing.
BAT, yep.
And that might have been fun. We were asked to share the responsibility with Dallara, because I really believe the Iconic Bull didn't think we had the wherewithal to put our money where our mouths were, as it were, and be able to follow through and produce the quantity of cars that they wanted. And they may well have been right. It would have been a very daunting prospect. But even if we had stayed with that program and shared it with Dallara and been part of the current IndyCar spec, it still wouldn't have been anywhere near as fun as what it was back in the day. I guess you could say that, you know, during the March era, it was almost a one-spec car, and during the lower era, it was almost a one-spec car, and during the Reynard era, it was almost a one-spec car. But there was always the opportunity there within the basic chassis of a March, a lower, a Reynard, you could still do your own thing, or you could still, as we did, come in with something brand new and challenge the establishment. And I think that's what really did make it the glory days, was the fact that it was still pretty much an open rule book, where of course it isn't now.
And that was Alan Mertens and the tale of his 1992 Galmer G92 Chevrolet Indy 500 winner. It's a really cool car, very distinct looked, very distinct everything, and with it effectively being one of very few one-and-done Indy 500 winners, even more rare, along with the closest ever finish that they achieved. All right, LaMarshall Pruitt. This is the Marshall Pruitt Podcast. Thanks for listening.